From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us. The use of force by law enforcement officers is an extremely fraught issue. I've heard from many in law enforcement that their profession exposes them to dangerous and often unpredictable threats. It's demanding in a way many people will probably never understand. Cops and deputies have a tremendous responsibility when it comes to handling these situations, and as a society, we give them broad discretion to use force, including deadly force. But in return, we demand an extremely high level of accountability. Now, the policies that govern just how much force a law enforcement officer can use and when they can use it can sometimes seem vague and subjective. And the Supreme Court cases that determine whether that force violates someone's civil rights sets up standards that sometimes don't line up with our own moral intuitions. In particular, the landmark Graham v. Conner case focuses in on what seems reasonable in the heat of the moment, not what might seem appropriate later, in hindsight. It can be a fine line that those in law enforcement have to walk, and in some cases, when that line gets crossed, the public can feel like the police are imposing a bigger threat to their community than the crimes they suspect are being committed. And of course, all of this is complicated by the near ubiquitous presence of smartphones. Back in 1991, the brutal beating of Rodney King by LAPD officers was probably the first time a bystander's video made a major difference in a police violence case. I was 10 at the time, but after I saw it on the news, even I understood. I'd just seen something horrifying, but also revolutionary. The beating might have gone unreported, but instead, the world had seen it. Now, even the most minor altercations seem to get filmed and end up on social media. These videos can be a powerful tool to hold law enforcement accountable, but they don't always tell the whole story. Sometimes, that's the result of deliberate manipulation, but in my experience, it's more commonly because these are chaotic situations, captured unexpectedly. A viral video is often the reason a journalist knows something happened, but the next steps are finding more information, looking for additional videos, talking to witnesses, and getting our hands on law enforcement video, like body cam and dash cam recordings. Today, I'm speaking with my colleague Aaliyah McConnell about an arrest that took place in November on Princess Place Drive in Wilmington. It was caught on video and shared on social media. And after reviewing that video, we had a lot of questions, and I'm sure the community and the family involved are looking for the same answers that we are. All right, Aaliyah, thanks for being here. You've done some extensive digging into this story. Can you catch us up on what you know so far?
Yeah, so there's a lot to unravel here, Ben. So back in December, a roughly two-minute video circulated on social media of 37-year-old Corey Timoney, who appears to be getting pinned down by a deputy of the New Hanover County Sheriff's Office and several other members of the Wilmington Police Department and one staff member of the fire department.
And as we know, we've got to worry about misleading labeling, deceptive editing, and even fake images these days. But you were able to verify some aspects of this viral video.
Right. We spoke to the person who took the video and confirmed this happened on Princess Place Drive, right off the corner of Maids Avenue, a few paces from the Career Readiness Academy at Mary S. Mosley Place.
And I'll just add, we know this is just one perspective. So you also talked to Timoney and witnesses and even looked at a second video. But we'd still like to see body cam footage from the officers involved to see if there's anything else we missed. And we're working on that, but under North Carolina law, it can be a lengthy legal process. And even if law enforcement agencies want to release the video, they can't just automatically do that. We'll have more on that later in the show, but for now, let's dig back into this viral video.
So I want to play a brief piece of the audio from that recording we saw on Facebook. You can hear the person filming the incident, whose name I wasn't able to verify, expressing their disapproval of what took place.
Don't kill the man! They need to stop beating people up. They ain't handle that white man like that.
Now, can you describe what you saw in the clip?
So Timoney's hands appear cuffed behind his back as he's on the ground, and it looks like his chest is pressed to the pavement under the weight of the deputy. It looks like Timoney is tossing around to loosen some of that pressure. After a minute or so, officers shackled his feet as well. But one of the more critical pieces seen in the footage is one instance where the sheriff's deputy appears to strike Timoney with an open palm on the side of his face, while it looks like Timoney is still pinned down and handcuffed.
And we should note, Timoney and other witnesses you spoke to say they saw the deputy's hand on Timoney's neck. That does appear to be what's happening in the video, but we can't be completely sure. We also know that witnesses and Timoney said there were at least three strikes to his head, but on the viral video, we can only see what appears like one strike, and that could be in part because the scene is obscured when a vehicle drives by, but we just don't know. That's actually one more reason we'd love to get some of the body cam footage so we could see a clearer version of what happened.
Right.
So, moving on with what we confirm, we know where this happened and we know when.
That arrest happened on November 25th, 2 days before Thanksgiving. And when Timoney was released from custody, he posted the video of his arrest to his personal Facebook page. That video's been shared over 580 times. Many people in the comments section shared the same sentiment, that it looked like law enforcement was going overboard.
You spoke with Timoney. Did he tell you why he decided to make his arrest public, like on social media?
Yeah, he wants the community to see what he described to us as excessive.
I'm not big on social media, but I just thought people should see what our officers that's supposed to protect and serve are doing to us men out here.
So tell us, how was it that Timoney ended up getting arrested here?
Well, that's the thing. Law enforcement weren't there to arrest Timoney at all. Spokesmen from both the sheriff's office and the police department confirmed that law enforcement was there as part of the Housing Task Force. That's a joint force between the two agencies, focusing on Wilmington Housing Authority neighborhoods like Creekwood, which isn't far from where the incident took place. But the task force was there arresting someone else completely. Timoney was in the area at the time getting a title notarized from an at-home notary, and I asked him what led up to his involvement, and this is what he recounts.
So from the beginning, I came across the street. They were detaining a friend of mine, a white guy named James, and I went over there and asked Officer DeBerry, could I retrieve his property? And he said yes, and when I got close enough, he grabbed me and said I had a warrant. And I didn't resist at all. They placed me under arrest and put me in the patrol car.
And what property was he trying to retrieve here?
He said it was a backpack and a bicycle that belonged to his friend James.
And you also spoke with some eyewitnesses of this incident. What did they say about what happened?
Yes. So I heard from a couple of people close to Timoney, his girlfriend Amanda Tuck, who can be seen in the video off to the side shouting, "Stop, Corey," in the video. She says she was worried Timoney wouldn't survive.
When he jerked him out the car, he still didn't try to hit him. He threw him to the ground. He put his knees in his back. He had one hand on his throat, and he struck him three different times in the side of the head, in his temple. He could have killed him.
Timoney's mother, Dentra Waddell, told me she saw the whole thing go down and asked the officer why he was hitting her son. She shared another video with me. This one she filmed herself, although it hasn't been circulated online.
And you talked with Dentra Waddell, and she gave you her takeaway from her conversation with the deputy that she filmed.
And the only excuse he came up with was like, those handcuffs that he have on is considered as a weapon. How can it be considered as a weapon? They own him, and his hands is down. How can he bring his hands up to hurt them? I don't see no way in doing that.
And here's a snippet from the interaction that she filmed with the deputy responding to Dentra.
Why did I hit him? Because he has, so these right here are blunt objects that he can hit me in the face with that he kept trying to turn and hit me with.
So let me make sure I'm getting this straight. Timoney's mother's interpretation was that deputies were saying the handcuffs on Timoney's wrists could have been used as a blunt instrument. And in general, the story is that Timoney went to gather his friend's belongings, and when he did, the cops and deputies identified that he had a warrant out for him, and then they put him in the back of a patrol car.
Well, the public information officer from the sheriff's office, Jerry Brewer, said Timoney approached the task force members and was belligerent, and when they saw that he had outstanding warrants, they proceeded to arrest him. They put him in the back of the patrol car with his hands cuffed behind his back, which he said put him in a lot of pain, so he tried moving his hands to the front.
Right, and just to add a little context, Timoni told you he has some complicating medical issues.
Right. Timoni says he was hospitalized in May of last year following a major car accident. I couldn't hear him saying anything to law enforcement about his injuries, and it's unclear whether he stated that before the video was taken. We haven't been able to independently verify his injuries with medical records, but he did show me photos of his wrecked car and of himself in the hospital. Timoni said the impact from the crash was so great that he was ejected from the sunroof of his car, resulting in 3 spinal fractures, a hip fracture, and a pelvic fracture. So his hands being restrained in the back caused him great discomfort, he told me. He said the deputy sitting with what felt like his full weight on top of his back didn't help either. Timoni says he told law enforcement that he had a difficult time breathing while the deputy's hand was around his neck. I spoke with one other witness, James A. Brown, a pastor of a local church, who you could see in the video attempting to calm everything down. Brown offered his account of what happened leading up to the incident, and this is what he says he saw.
There were 2 gentlemen being arrested. One of them I knew, his name was James. He's a Caucasian fellow, you know, real nice guy, you know, he's homeless. But they were arresting him.
So that lines up with Timoni's version of events in that Pastor Brown says Timoni saw this James individual was going to be arrested and wanted to keep James's belongings safe.
That's right. And Brown noticed a crowd of people surrounding the other person being arrested, which was Timoni. And he says he felt the situation was growing volatile. When he went over there, he says he saw Timoni in the back seat with handcuffs on.
They snatched Corey out of the back of the car and threw him to the ground. He still had cuffs on. There was about 3 or 4 officers that were wrestling and tussling with him. And he was kind of threatening the officers, telling them what he was going to do to them once they let him go if they take the cuffs off.
Brown also said he heard one of the officers say that Timoni was threatening to kick the windows out of the police car. Since he's currently being held in pretrial custody for drug charges unrelated to this case, I haven't been able to confirm this directly with Timoni. But Brown witnessed most of the arrest, and he says the threats to kick out their windows is why they took Timoni out and restrained his feet.
And so they had him restrained on the ground, and when they finished restraining him, his legs were tied as well, or restrained as well. And they took him and put him back in the car once this was over. And the police officer was telling everyone that he said he was going to kick the windows out of the police car.
According to Brown, the deputy was exchanging insults with Timoni as well. Brown watched the deputy perform a search of another backpack that belonged to Timoni personally. And this is what he remembers from that.
I did notice that he seemed to be taunting him. You know, they were both exchanging words. And instead of him searching Corey's bag, he would just stand there and just stare him down, you know. But I felt like another officer should have taken him out of the situation and just kind of took over searching the bag because he had stopped doing so.
So you found out from arrest reports that the officials involved were Deputy Jay Jenkins of the Sheriff's Office, who was allegedly pinning Timoni down, and Officer Jay DeBerry of the Wilmington Police Department, who is listed as the arresting officer on all of the reports for this incident. And you spoke with law enforcement, so what has their reaction been to this so far?
Well, I reached out to both agencies for comments on the situation. Since it was a task force arrest that the police department signed all the court documents for, but from Timoni and the witnesses' point of view, it's been the sheriff's deputies' actions that are of concern. In any case, it's been like a game of accountability hot potato between the two agencies. I submitted a records request to the police department, and I was sent back court documents that I already obtained online through eCourts. And I filed a request with the sheriff's office, and they directed me back to the police department. Early on in my investigation, I spoke directly with Jerry Brewer when I began looking into this in December. Again, he's the PIO for the sheriff's office, who told me Deputy Jenkins went to a medical center to get checked out for injuries to his wrist, claiming Timoni had attempted to hurt him. However, Brewer said it turned out that Jenkins was okay.
And later you followed up and got some more detail.
Yes, I spoke with Brewer again in late February, and he told me that Timoney had been successful in somehow moving his hands from behind his back to the front of his body, which is what prompted Jenkins. Brewer said while Jenkins was attempting to re-handcuff Timoney, his wrists intertangled with the cuffs. Andy says that Jenkins struck Timoney because he perceived Timoney was being resistant in that moment. The strike, Brewer says, is within NHCSO's continuum of force outlined in their code of conduct, which we'll get into in a bit here. Since both agencies have said they're limited on what they can speak on, the bulk of what I know comes from videos, witnesses, court documents, and my conversation with Timoney one-on-one. I know he was charged with two counts of resisting a public officer for physically resisting and trying to slip his handcuffs to the front of his body. The documents also showed that he was charged with possession of cocaine and drug paraphernalia.
And based on what you heard from Timoney, he was expecting a more substantial sentence. Normally, felony cocaine possession can mean 3 to 12 months, and that can be on probation. But if the person has a significant number of prior convictions, like Timoney does, they're much more likely to serve actual jail time.
Well, court documents show he ended up taking a plea deal in which he paid a $500 fine and got time served for the 8 days he was in custody at the county detention center. Timoney said he felt like people were surprised, and he himself thought he would have to serve some prison time given his record, convictions for felonies, and serious misdemeanors, including weapons and assault offenses.
That would have had to do something. That would have had to do some time with the record that I have.
Okay, Aaliyah, I want to dig deeper into the whole question of use of force here.
To be clear, Timoney is upfront about his criminal history, but maintains that he wasn't resisting during this arrest. And he feels like the officers involved were aggressive, especially after taking strikes to the head, as he claims.
So law enforcement agencies usually have a policy on use of force. So what do the policies for our local law enforcement agencies say here?
According to the police department's use of force policy, under state law, the use of force is justified when someone is trying to escape custody or when an officer feels the need to defend themselves or anyone else they believe to be in imminent danger. Also, their policy states that when any level of force has been used, the officer must render medical aid, which Timoney says was done, but not adequately.
I'm having hearing issues now. Like, I feel like he ruptured my eardrum. I went to the hospital for a CAT scan. I'm not sure if it went all the way through.
Timoney claims that the CAT scan wasn't performed properly because he says he was still wearing handcuffs. Again, we haven't independently verified this with the medical records, but it was Timoney's claims.
Okay, noted. So back to the use of force policies.
The language used in the sheriff's office policy on use of force is meant to reflect the spirit of the Fourth Amendment in the Constitution, which hinges on reasonableness. Their policy states that an officer can use the level of force they believe is reasonably necessary to arrest someone. The same rule applies if they're trying to prevent an escape, or defend themselves and any others, or to subdue someone in a mental health crisis. They have a use of force options model that ranges from officer presence, verbal commands, physical force, the use of hard or soft hands, and deadly force.
So, was there anything else from the video or that you learned in your reporting that could have contributed to what seems like the escalation that happened in the video we watched?
Well, Timoney did have a warrant for a driving while license revoked, not impaired charge out of Brunswick County, though at the time he believed those charges had been cleared from his record. Also, after listening closely to the video that was shared with me by his mother, again, that hasn't been posted online, you can hear the deputy saying that Timoney approached them with drug paraphernalia in his hand. However, Timoney maintains that the officers gave him permission to walk across the street to get James's items. Again, that was the gentleman being arrested at first. And at least one of the officers already knew who Timoney was, as you can hear in this video that Timoney's mother showed me.
We arrested Corey
7 times.
And just a quick note here, the audio quality there is obviously not great. We ran a little bit of noise reduction on it, but it's still very buzzy. But you can make out a law enforcement officer saying, quote, "We've arrested Corey 7 times. We know all about him."
Yes, and in that same video from Timoni's mom, you can hear a witness also describe the incident in their own words.
Corey, he knew the dude, so he just like crossed the street. And then they just, as soon as he crossed the street, they just threw him in the handcuffs and started taking his book bag off for no reason. He could have just been walking down the sidewalk.
So one of our key questions was this. Based on what we've seen and heard, were Timoni's rights under the Fourth Amendment that grants protection from unreasonable searches and seizures infringed upon? But there's another question. The Fourth Amendment also has a key role in determining what force is allowable and what's considered excessive.
Well, if Timoni decides to take any sort of legal action, that would be determined in court. I did speak with Jeff Welty. He's an expert on policing and use of force at the UNC School of Government. And while he can't comment on the specifics of this case or any case, he did help me get a better understanding of excessive force and what that means under the Fourth Amendment.
So I think for most purposes, when people think about excessive force, they think about the kind of force that would violate the Constitution and give rise to civil liability for the arresting officer. And the legal standard for the use of force is that officers may use only such force as is reasonably necessary to carry out their duties, such as arresting a suspect. And they can use deadly force only when there's an imminent risk of death or great bodily injury to the officer or others. And those standards come from a series of Supreme Court cases, the most significant of which are Tennessee versus Garner and Graham versus Connor.
Now, there are a number of Supreme Court cases that shape how the Fourth Amendment is interpreted in use of force situations. But I want to talk about the landmark Graham versus Connor case.
Yes, in the Graham v. Connor case, the court ruled that a claim of excessive force by a police officer should be measured against an objective reasonableness standard, rather than that officer's good faith intent. In other words, if given the same facts known at the time, would another officer in that same situation with the same level of training respond in a similar way?
And we learned what qualifies as use of force is probably broader than most people tend to think.
That's true. And Welty goes into detail of what those in law enforcement call a continuum of uses of force. That can be anything from handcuffing a suspect up to deadly force, as Welty explains.
As you go up the spectrum, there's different techniques, from so-called soft hands techniques, where officers might be grabbing a suspect or physically restraining or controlling them with their hands, to hard hands techniques, where officers are delivering strikes with their hands or fists or feet, to the use of different types of less lethal weaponry, to the use of tasers and other like electrical conduction weapons, all the way to the use of deadly force, like the discharge of a firearm against a suspect. All those would be uses of force, and all of them might be lawful under certain circumstances, but whether a particular use of force is lawful in a particular circumstance depends on what's reasonable, how much of a threat the person that law enforcement's dealing with poses, and how much of a threat they are to the officer and to others.
And Welty told you there's a lot of gray areas when determining whether the level of force used by an officer was lawful or not.
That's right. It varies case by case. But Graham v. Connor did set a few key criteria to weigh whether an officer's use of force was objectively reasonable, known as the Graham factors. The severity of the crime, whether the suspect posed an immediate threat, and whether a suspect actively resists an arrest or flees are the standards that comprise the Graham factors. The repercussions for officers who are found in violation of their agency's use of force policy or the standards set forth by the Constitution also varies.
there's three basic kinds of consequences. The first is if an officer violates their agency policy with regard to the level of force that they use, they can face discipline by their agency up to and including termination. The second is there can be civil liability for an officer who uses excessive force, and that civil liability might attach to the officer, or it might essentially be paid or covered by the agency. And then the third consequence, which really goes beyond what we've talked about, is in cases where the force was clearly unauthorized, it might constitute criminal activity under state law. And we saw that, for example, in the George Floyd case, where officers used force against Mr. Floyd, and it was determined that not only was it unauthorized by law or agency policy, but it was so egregious that it constituted criminal activity, and the officers were prosecuted criminally. So those are the three kinds of consequences that can exist.
Okay, Aaliyah, what are some of your key takeaways from your reporting on this case so far?
Well, again, I think it's worth repeating that Timoney doesn't shy away from the fact that he has a checkered past, but he doesn't think that that should have made him a target.
Every person has a past. Mine was a little extensive. But you cannot keep any person in the same category. People grow up. People change their way of living after a while.
And he claims that he never resisted the officers. Even when he was moving his handcuffs, he says that was because of the discomfort caused from his previous injuries, not in defiance of the officers. When we're looking at the applications of the Fourth Amendment, he may have the stable grounds to believe that the manner in which he was apprehended was disproportionate to the perceived offense in that moment, or the offense laid out in his warrant.
So what is Timoney hoping the outcome will be if he decides to litigate the matter?
Well, now that this case has been disposed, he's hoping that it would bring about some reform.
A lot of them, there are some good officers out there, and they protect and serve. They do their job. But the moment you cross that line and start bullying and assaulting people, you should lose your badge. And I feel like that officer should have never struck me.
Pastor James A. Brown, who you heard from earlier in this story, took note of the community's reaction to the police being in their neighborhood that day.
They didn't like the fact that they were there. There were people riding up and down the road. They were cursing the cops out. They were blowing their horns at the cops, you know, just some even stopped in the middle of the street.
Brown has heard from many people in the area who say they wouldn't call the cops, period, even in an emergency. But he understands how that distrust can hurt both sides, the members of the community and the police officers who've sworn to protect them.
It's hurtful. It's very hurtful. I wish there was something that we could do to open up a dialogue between the police department and the people in this community. There has to be a better system put in place to handle certain situations. It's hurtful to see them being treated the way they are treated sometimes. It's hurtful to see them behave towards the police officers the way they behave towards them. But there's a lack of trust.
This, building trust between law enforcement and the community, is the bigger issue at hand, not just for Timoney or Brown, but everyone who lives along Princess Place Drive. Everyone wants a safe neighborhood, and there's been some progress. Creekwood South, a public housing complex located just off this road, has seen a 33% drop in crime levels in 2024, according to data released from the police department, which means the area is becoming safer. But if Timoney's story teaches us anything, it's that there's still much work to be done in mending that community's reputation of being a high-crime area, and with how the police interact with the residents living there.
That's definitely something to think about. So, last thing before we go. As I mentioned at the top, North Carolina law puts up some barriers to getting law enforcement video like dash and body cam. Basically, you have to petition a superior court judge who reviews a host of considerations, including if there's a compelling public interest and whether the release could impact an investigation.
That's right. I'm working through that process with the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press and the Duke Law First Amendment Clinic to obtain body camera footage from WPD so I can understand what happened completely. It's coming along, but we wanted to have this discussion first to kind of lay out what we know so far.
Absolutely, yeah. And we'll have links to the video that Corey Timoney posted, as well as the video Dentra Waddell shared with you, Ilya, so folks can see what we saw and also what we didn't see. Plus, we'll have links to reporting on North Carolina's body cam laws and use of force cases in general for folks who would like to learn more about this. Ilya, I know there's a lot more to cover on this process, and I'm sure you'll keep us up to date. But for now, thanks for your reporting.
Yeah, so thanks for having me on to talk about this, Ben. Now let's get back to work.
All right, well, that's it for today's show. Thanks to my colleague Ilya McConnell for their work on this story. Thanks as well to the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, which does great work helping journalists understand their rights and navigating what's been an increasingly complex and hostile legal terrain, and the Duke Law First Amendment Clinic, which has provided representation for journalists like myself and my colleagues here at WHQR, especially on issues like public records and other things dealing with transparency. Both of these are incredible resources for small newsrooms in particular that might not have in-house counsel or otherwise be able to afford legal help. And thanks, as always, to WHQR Program Director Ken Campbell. Music for today's show was provided by If These Trees Could Talk and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have questions, comments, concerns, or an idea for a future show, that last one is our favorite, email us at newsroom@whqr.org. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.